Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Greg Iles, who has a new novel, which is actually the second of a trilogy, The Middle Point. I guess the two towers of the trilogy.
There you go. Perfect comparison.
The Bone Tree. Earlier novels. There are 15 in all. The first novel in this series, Natchez Burning, and the third novel, Unwritten Laws, I guess will be coming out in 2016.
Yes, that's correct.
These books deal with racism and corruption in the American South in the 1960s and today. They feature a character named Penn Cage, who has appeared in earlier novels. And before we get into this trilogy, I want to go back. You'd written these two World War II novels. You've written a couple of other thrillers. And you grew up in Natchez. And you decided to have a character in Natchez and kind of make it the central location of your novels. And that's, I guess, Penn Cage. When he came in, this prosecutor from Houston, had you any idea that you would reuse him or the other characters like Dwight Stone from The Quiet Game?
No idea, Richard. When I initially wrote the first Penn Cage novel, Quiet Game, in 1996, it was meant to be a standalone, never intended to use him again. And I've gotten in trouble because I've sort of been anti-series in my life. You know, publishers, what they want you to do, whatever makes them money, they essentially want you to just rewrite that book again and again. A lot of writers do that. I've always been against it. But with Penn Cage, about every 7 years, he would call to me with an issue or a story. And so I wrote three before making Penn the focal point of this trilogy.
When you say it called you, what does that mean exactly?
Unlike a lot of writers, as I was sort of getting at, I've been lucky enough to write across several genres. I've written about many subjects. As you said, the Second World War, the Holocaust, everything from that to repressed memories of child abuse, artificial intelligence. I've written about a lot of things. But in Penn Cage, what I had, and in the milieu of Natchez itself in Mississippi, it gave me a canvas, as Faulkner talked about, my own little postage stamp of native soil that I knew, or as Stephen King says, I know where all the roads go. And that is the canvas where, if I'm going to really write meaningful books, that's the best setting that I can use. And so every few years, when a certain subject would come up that I wanted to deal with, I mean, they weren't as meaningful as this book, perhaps. Like, for a while I got interested in dogfighting and casino gambling, and a book came out of that, and I used Penn and I used Natchez. Another time I got interested in things I knew about affairs going on between grown men and high school girls, you know, and there it was. Penn began as a sort of Grisham-esque character, almost too good to be true. Your typical guy who's a white liberal guy who went to law school and, you know, looking for meaning in his life. But over the course of these books, he's grown into something much more complicated and been forced to reevaluate everything in his life. And so it's fun to take a character who feels sure of himself and pull the rug out, because that happens to a lot of us in our lives.
The rug gets pulled out quite a bit in The Bone Tree in particular. But dealing with Natchez, in fact, you're dealing with the American South today, which not too many people really want to look at. I remember talking not long ago with Paul Theroux, who told me his next book, his travel book, is going to be a tour through the South, because he said much of it is like third world Africa.
I would disagree with that, and I'd love to debate him on the show. Here's what I'll tell you about the South. On one hand, it's been a lucky thing that the South in many ways remain underdeveloped for the modern age, because for writers and artists in particular, musicians, it remained a place steeped in a sense of identity that the rest of the country has lost. You know, I get off the interstate or out of a plane anywhere in the country, it all looks the same, it sounds the same, it feels the same. In the South, you're still very much in a place. If you're in Louisiana, it's unique. If you're in Mississippi, it's unique. Now, certainly, parts of it are poverty-stricken, and things like education and health care are behind. But that said, I'll tell you this. Most of the guys I ever knew who came from the North to run plants in the South, the first year they would get there, their wives would complain, and they would complain. Every single one of them retired there. They never went back North. Why is that? Why does Morgan Freeman, who could live anywhere in the world, come back to Mississippi and keep his house there and have a club there? there's something about the place that's wonderful.
Of course, here in California and in the North, when we think of the South, we think of extreme right-wingers, we think of the KKK,
mm-hmm.
and we think of black oppression.
Sure you do, but I would ask you to think about this. If you're watching the news right now, where are you seeing the most significant race problems? Ferguson, a corner in New York City, you know, Baltimore, all over the country. You're not seeing it in Selma, Alabama or Jackson, Mississippi. Race is a nationwide problem. And that's one thing I get at in these books. In the South, yes, we had terrible race problems, but what we did not have was hypocrisy. The terrible things that happened, happened right out in front of you, okay? In the North, as Charles Evers and some black commentators would tell you, they would rather deal with a guy they knew hated them or disagreed with everything they stood for than a guy who smiled, shook their hand, but secretly despised them or felt prejudice toward them. And in the 60s, it was very easy to look at the South and say, oh, look how terrible it is. But as soon as large numbers of African Americans moved north to find high paying jobs after the wars, you saw racism spring up all over the country.
Is this one of the reasons why the racist characters in Natchez Burning and The Bone Tree are so upfront about their racism? I mean, they're really upfront about it.
Sure they are. I mean, they would, in fact, if someone like that was here having a conversation, he might say, to address Paul Theroux's point, he may say, well, okay, look, the liberal Democrats got what they wanted in the 60s, and they passed all these laws, and they got equality. And look what we got. We got public schools with a graduation rate of less than 50%. We've got a whole underclass that can't provide for itself. And they would argue right up to your face that the great society was a failure.
And what do you think, Greg Iles?
I think it's a complex issue. It's easy to say something like that. That's like looking at post-colonial Africa and saying that the Belgians are... These European powers were right when they say, well, we can't set these African countries free because there'll be chaos. Well, they were right. It was. But that's part of a necessary stage as you progress towards something else.
Well, of course, it's also the result to some degree of post-colonialism.
Exactly.
And just as the South today is the result of slavery.
That's right. And I think nationwide we deny that. I think what I try to urge people to think about, because of the laws passed in the 60s, people sort of mentally erase slavery, and they tend to look at African Americans as another immigrant group, but that they sort of can't get it together. And they don't see that about the only parallel to me to African Americans are Native Americans. Native Americans had their land stolen from them and their culture eradicated. African Americans had the reverse. They were stolen from their land and had their culture eradicated, and neither group, despite this being 2015, has ever recovered from that cultural eradication that occurred.
And at the same time, of course, they're not necessarily being allowed to recover from
exactly
the mainstream
right.
as well.
Exactly.
Well, Greg Iles, let's go on to Natchez Burning. From what I read, the impetus for the book, and I guess at some point you did want to tackle racism directly in your novels. In 1964, a well-respected African-American merchant was killed, and his shoe repair store was burned to the ground by the KKK in Louisiana. This was the origin of the story of the music store?
It was. Really, for me, I'll give you some reality about the South. Even though I'm a thriller writer from the South, I'd always avoided using the KKK because the KKK itself was effectively infiltrated and neutralized by 1965 by the FBI. Frank Morris, the shoe repair man, and others in that area in Concordia Parish were murdered by a violent offshoot of the Ku Klux Klan called the Silver Dollar Group. In my book, they're called the Double Eagle Group. These were some hardcore guys, former military men who knew the Klan had been infiltrated, that the FBI was in the community. They didn't have meetings. All they did was carry a silver dollar minted in the year of their birth, and all they did was kill people, burn people out, rape people, and not even one was arrested for 40 years after these crimes. So a friend of mine was heroically investigating these crimes, began about 8 years ago. Within 2 years, he outpaced the FBI. This is a guy working for a tiny little paper in Faraday, Louisiana, home of Jimmy Swaggart and Jerry Lee Lewis. And within 2 years, he had the FBI coming to him for information, and he was he's a finalist for the Pulitzer 2 years ago. And this is a guy who makes no money, purely working out of a sense of justice.
So he was telling you about all this, and suddenly the little light bulb goes off?
The light came on. My father had passed away just before I started this trilogy, and he had always been the inspiration for Dr. Tom Cage. My dad was a physician in Mississippi, and he had about 60% African-American patient base, and he was beloved. But when my dad died, I knew I wanted to explore his life and some other lives more deeply. At its core, this is a father-son story, and I like what one reviewer said, which was, imagine Jim Finch grew up to learn things about Atticus no son should ever know about his father, you know. And so through Penn learning that his father had a secret life intertwined with black culture, I get to explore a lot of things about the South. But then I realized as I explored the black woman in the novel, I wanted a richer tapestry. And that became Stanley Nelson's heroic investigations into these real-life crimes. They're very thinly disguised in the book, and I had Stanley's, you know, collaboration all the way through.
The Bone Tree is where the bones of all of these African-Americans were kept and where they were tortured by this offshoot of the KKK, and it's in a swamp. Was there a bone tree?
There's not a bone tree. I'll tell you what there was. What inspired the bone tree was, at the time that most of these victims were missing, the FBI knew they had heard rumors, persistent rumors, of a house where this kind of activity was going. It was set up as a torture place. Most of the victims were African American, but some, interestingly, were white. You know, the Klan, chapters of the Klan frequently had a pastor or reverend sort of as a key member. Sometimes they would punish their own members or white men for, say, selling alcohol to underage people or having an affair with somebody's wife, as well as African Americans. But I didn't want something as prosaic as a house in my novel. I wanted something that symbolized the atavistic part of human nature. And to me, because these guys were rural, they're all rural men, hunters, those kind of things, I wanted something with a tie to the land. And this 700-year-old cypress tree, big enough for 10 men to get inside, once you've seen something like that, you know that's it.
But before we went on the air, we were talking about these two books, and Bone Tree is essentially a thriller, but Natchez Burning is something else because of its relation to actual history. As you were writing Natchez Burning, were you suddenly becoming aware that on some level your trilogy could be unbalanced that way?
Yes. Well, I'll tell you how it really happened. And I spent a year working on Natchez Burning, trying to make it one novel. Pretty quickly, I realized there's no way any conventional novel is going to contain this story. It was outgrowing itself. I had some conversations with my publisher. They were not happy with the idea of multiple books. And I was in a pretty upset state and trying to deal with these problems when I pulled on the Highway 61 and a truck hit my driver's door going 70 miles an hour. You know, took my leg off, tore my aorta, crushed my pelvis, broke all my ribs. I came out of a coma 8 days later, and I had a completely different perspective. In my view, from that point, I said, I don't care if anybody buys it. I don't care if the publisher wants it. I don't care who gets mad. If it takes three books, it takes three books, you know? And that's what I did. And in short order, I lost my publisher, my agent, and my last book had been number one in the country. You know, you can be sitting on top of the world and 1 year later unemployed. That's what I found out. But, you know, I turned it around. I did what I wanted to do. It took a while, and now, you know, a month ago, I signed a deal for this book to become the next True Detective for a budget of equivalent to Game of Thrones. I mean, this is, you know, as happy ending as you can get to. A lot of suffering, but I made it.
It's True Detective now?
We sold it after a six-network bidding war, the entire trilogy, to be a cable series like True Detective or Game of Thrones.
So that's going to be on Amazon, though.
It's going to be on Amazon Prime because they're taking on Netflix now in the drama arena. You know, they've won some Emmys in comedy and stuff.
And Tobey Maguire's the star?
Well, Toby's exec producing with myself and David Hudgens of Friday Night Lights, okay? Toby is very interested in starring. He hasn't committed until he sees the actual script. But, yes, Toby's the man.
given the number of bestsellers, it's rather surprising that there's only been one movie made from any of your books.
Well, think about it, though. You know why? It's because I write such long and complex books. They're really too complex to be a 120-page feature film script.
One way to make the book manageable, I guess, is to make Penn Cage a novelist writing in the first person. So you've suddenly got first person and third person right through there.
That's true. Well, you know, that's something I debated about with a buddy of mine who discovered me on my very first book. I started writing first person present when I went back and reread Presumed Innocent by a bandmate of mine, Scott Turow, and I think that's probably the best exercise of that voice ever accomplished. And to me, it's the most immediate voice, but it's also the most difficult. And I'll tell you why. Think about it. If you write in the past tense, you're writing as if something's an accomplished fact. I'm telling you a story. You know, yesterday I flew into San Francisco and a guy shot at me, whatever. It sounds like I'm telling a story. But if I'm first person present, I'm saying, so I'm standing there and I'm flying into San Francisco and I get off the plane and a guy shoots at me. That gives you an infinite number of times to go, oh, that didn't really happen. You know what I mean? It's a tough voice to execute.
Laurie Moore said that present tense in particular is very tough because it actually is a constricting tense.
Very constricting. Very much. And so mixing tenses, that was something I wasn't sure I wanted to do, but I knew I didn't want to switch to complete third person because I didn't want to lose that immediacy of first. So ultimately I decided the pitfall of mixing is this. The risk is third person is usually omniscient, and if you reveal too much in those scenes, your hero appears stupid because he's behind the curve. You got to be very careful about that.
Well, there's one point where you're very close third person with Tom Cage, the father, and something is about to happen to him, and then you pull him off screen for 100 pages.
Well, sometimes you have to be a little manipulative, okay? A little bit. I try not to be, but...
Let's get back to Natchez Burning. When you were growing up in the 60s in Natchez, at this point, given what we know of America today, it's not as shocking. But in the 60s, it would have been the level of corruption in the federal government and in the state government and in the police.
That's true. And that's true of certain states and cities in particular. You would think of cities like Chicago and ones like that. But New Orleans in particular, which I visit in this book, probably the most corrupt city in the United States. As I say in the book, and nothing against the French, but they say areas that were colonized by the French tend to become about as decadent as anywhere. But to the point about the 60s and growing up in Natchez, you know, I was born in 1960, which you would think I'm a little young to have lived through the stuff and remember. However, like a lot of Southern men, I was raised by an African-American maid, and I don't mean she just cleaned my house. I received most of my ethical education from that woman. And in 1965, the biggest Ku Klux Klan meeting in the history of the United States was held 1/2 mile from my house. My dad, he was a courageous guy. He walked me down the road with his Nikon camera, shooting pictures the whole way. And I remember to this day, not only the men wearing robes, but the women and children and the horses in the full Klan regalia. It was a really scary thing. There were some firebombings in Natchez, certainly the murder of Horace Jackson, and all those things, even though they weren't covered in the public forums like the paper extensively, within the community there was a lot of unrest.
And you came from, what, liberal Democrat family?
Yes, but of course they didn't say that then. They certainly kept their head down, you know. My dad always has said he wished he'd done more, and he did a lot for individual black people. And I have people come up to me at book signings today and tell me stories. Black people who just bring me to tears and tell me something I never knew my dad did. And so I'm proud of that. But, you know, he went through his life feeling he didn't do enough.
Like the character of Tom Cage.
Yes,
feels
that's
the same way. But that also leaves you and your hero in a very unusual position. What are you going to do and how are you going to try to change things?
Well, that's right. And I'll tell you something I just did. In Natchez, we have a 83-year-old tradition that began as what was called the Confederate pageant. Now it's called the Historic Natchez Tableau. It was pretty much an unapologetic celebration of the slaveholding South, like the first 20 minutes of Gone with the Wind. I just took a month and a half of my life, rewrote the whole thing and integrated it with a 50% African-American cast and used music from Slave Times all the way through Sam Cooke. And it is so edgy, you wouldn't believe it. And the thing made money for the first time in 7 years, and it was packed. And so, you know, I'm doing what I can do to be there. You know?
Are we ever going to see a liberal South?
A liberal South? I would tell you this. It's sad that too many people in the South and in the rest of the country, in the red states, almost seem to feel like somehow if you cling to these worn-out notions of nostalgia, you can somehow bring back Eisenhower America. You know, that will never come, and it wouldn't be a good thing if it did come. But I can tell you this. There are a lot more liberals in the South than you know about. They're not outspoken.
Shift gears slightly into something that's in the bone tree, which is the JFK assassination. I had assumed that, by and large, events were kind of settled. Until not long ago, I was speaking with Dennis Lehane, who mentioned the godfather of New Orleans and his involvement in the Kennedy assassination, and he mentioned it in a way that indicated that this is what had actually happened, and not only is it what actually happened, but it's what most people in the know actually happened.
I didn't know Dennis was interested in that. And as you see in the bone tree, I don't want to reveal too much about the book. I never was a Kennedy conspiracy theorist, but the whole sort of Oliver Stone view that there is some massive, monolithic right-wing conspiracy that penetrated all levels of government, that's always been impossible. That even if it had happened, it could never have stayed secret. We all know that. So if a conspiracy occurred, it had to be very, very small, very tightly held. And we know from Oswald randomly getting the job at the book depository very late, the conspiracy would have to happen very late as well. There's only one group of events that fits that, and that is Carlos Marcello. You know, people know a lot about some of the northern New York mafia figures. They don't know a lot about Carlos Marcello, but Carlos was literally the most powerful mafioso in the country.
And Robert Kennedy wanted to send Carlos Marcello back to Italy.
In fact, did illegally deport him once, and Carlos got back into the country almost immediately. And then, of course, once John Kennedy was elected president, once that happened, it was a matter of time. Bobby, it was his highest priority to deport Carlos permanently, and that would have meant the end of a higher-than-a-billion-dollar empire, and that's 1960s dollars.
The story of the JFK murder, which we can probably go into in a little more depth because you have fictional characters involved,
yeah,
obviously.
Yeah.
But the research that you did, how likely is it that the fictional characters, let's say, are actually real characters who are somewhat different?
I'll tell you this. The guy who is the character Ray Presley in The Bone Tree, and he was one of the chief antagonists in The Quiet Game. I can say this now because he's dead. He was a patient of my father's who was a Natchez police detective. He had worked as a police officer in New Orleans in the pay of Carlos Marcello, like many police officers. He took me on a tour of New Orleans in the early 1990s. That was one of the most shocking things I'd ever seen. Not only did he take me to the spots where the Marcello mob normally met, and I met several guys in that business, he took me into the offices of some of the highest officials, law enforcement, in the city of New Orleans. And those guys let him in without an appointment, and they were distinctly uncomfortable, but we would sit there for an hour. And what I saw then was any barrier that might exist between the criminal organizations and law enforcement in New Orleans was about the most porous border you could imagine.
You do make connections between David Ferry and Oswald, and toward the end of the book, there's a sequence involving Fidel Castro. Is that based on anything?
Well, that part is based on my deductions, and I tell you, I don't write books that have to do with serial killers or any of that anymore. I feel like that's kind of over. But I did a lot of research on that in the early 2000s and the 1990s, and it was that research, a lot of psychological, behavioral research, that when I reviewed the Kennedy material, it seemed obvious to me that the most likely conspiracy depended on a nexus of connection between Oswald and Ferry. Nobody'd ever been able to prove that. There'd been accounts of that. So I asked myself the simplest question using Occam's razor. Okay, is it conceivable that there would be a kind of relationship for which no evidence would remain and then both men would have an interest in keeping secret? And to me, given what was known about David Ferry being a child molester, that seemed the obvious thing. Also, we know that Oswald was in Ferry's Civil Air Patrol unit. He was a teenager. We know Ferry had been fired from a major airline for molesting boys, and the pattern seemed pretty obvious.
So all you need is some Cuban intelligence to put two and two together.
And, you know, you can actually remove the Cuban element of my sort of theory, and still the Oswald Ferry thing is sufficient. But, you know, I'm not going to assert, oh, I know what happened. But I would say this. If Oswald did not act alone, I think what's in this book is probably pretty close to what happened.
Greg Iles, your accident must have affected the writing of how Penn Cage views mortality. On some level, could have changed your view of doing damage to characters who have been appearing in six books.
I'll tell you what I'm thinking about doing, in all honesty. I almost don't want to give any heads up for this at all, but it did change the way I look at violence and trauma and the randomness of events. You know, when fate sort of reaches out and slaps you and nearly kills you, you realize how arbitrary everything is. And I had some discussions about that with my bandmate Stephen King, who went through something very similar, you know, when he was run over by the van. It changes you fundamentally. And as an artist, of course, all we have to sell is ourselves, basically, and our own suffering. There will be at least one Penn book that follows this trilogy, and I'm thinking about putting him through a similar trauma to give people an insight into what that's really like. Because I think we're all subject to the whatever, you know, these, it may not be a car accident, it may be an illness, it may be whatever that occurs at the stage in life where we passed 45 or so, and I certainly got some insight into that. And it's good to weaken a hero, I think. What's the use of reading about heroes who are superhuman? We want to read about people, I hope, who go through more than we have and have insight.
It also means that when you're continuing the series, you're removing pieces from the board, too.
That's exactly right. Yeah, from a writer's, how would you call that, talking shop, you know, inside baseball, it's like killing the character. You get a lot of bang from that, and then you've removed a piece from the board. And, I mean, this is unrelated, but look at a show, for example,
Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones has done it successfully. But look at a show like Downton Abbey. They had to kill characters they necessarily didn't even want to kill because actors wanted to move on or whatever. And I think the show probably has suffered past the point of being able to survive by losing certain characters. And you never want to intentionally go too far as an artist.
You also, by bringing in characters from other books, in particular Jordan, who's a leading character from another book, making her a secondary character, if you were to do something to her, by bringing her in and putting her in mortal danger, let's say, by putting Jordan in mortal danger, you change the nature of that earlier novel. I mean, people go back and suddenly things are different reading the earlier book.
That's right. I think you're right about that. And I brought Jordan in, I think, because Kaiser was so integral to this book, and I felt that they had wound up together at the end of Dead Sleep, which is one of my favorite books I've done. I've always felt an urge to go back to Jordan with a full book as well, because I think her role as a combat photographer offers a lot of possibilities.
Is she based on anybody?
She is based on a couple of female photographers from the 60s. One in particular, she was actually ultimately killed in combat.
When you're working on a book like Bone Tree, how difficult or easy is it to maintain the suspense in the face of what is going to be a lot of exposition?
I'd just say straight up, you know, these books aren't really for everybody. You know, now I don't want somebody to look at it and think, well, that book's 800 pages. There's no way it would hold my interest. Because the amazing thing about these books is Natchez Burning and Bone Tree together are about 1,600 pages, and they only cover about 8 days. you could tell three James Michener multi-generational stories in 600 pages, and I'm covering 8 days. But that gets at something I always point out to people who want to be writers. I try to explain the nature of time in books to them. I've written about the Second World War. I could write about 1939 to 1945 in a novel in 300 pages, or I could write about 17 seconds on Omaha Beach for 300 pages. That's how elastic time is in novels. And so when you ask about an issue like maintaining suspense, I don't worry about that. I feel like if people stick with my exposition, they know I'm going to rip them out of their preconceptions pretty soon. You know, I don't worry about that.
Forrest Knox, who is the villain of The Bone Tree, is a corrupt cop on the verge of basically running the state cops of Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a novel, and it's a thriller, and he's a bad guy. But at the same time, how likely is there an actual Forrest Knox?
I'd say if parts of the book are exaggerated, hopefully it's that part. But I'll tell you this. I lived in New Orleans when my first wife was in dental school in the early 90s when it was the homicide capital of the United States. And at that point, what broke out into public knowledge was some cops were actually taking money to kill people. At that point, that's how corrupt the police force was.
Then let me ask you this. There's a key moment where they find out that cops are actually shooting African Americans during Katrina because they want to get rid of other drug dealers. Mm-hmm. Is that a story that you heard?
I've heard a lot of stories like that about Katrina. And, of course, we all know, just like stories about riots or anything like that, the things that you first hear are rarely true. You know, during Katrina, we started hearing stories that they were raping people in the restroom in the Superdome and all these, you know, panic sort of breaks out. Chris Kyle apparently made some claims about, you know, working as a sniper during the Katrina and, you know, sort of having a free fire rules of engagement. That's been really called into question as to whether any of that happened. And I would say that most of what you hear are rumors. But if you ask me, do I believe that certainly private individuals and probably some law enforcement carried out some unauthorized retaliation or preventive firing, I would say yes, I think that happened.
It's not a big part of the book. In fact, it's very much in the background, a kind of conspiracy to keep New Orleans as white as it became after Katrina.
Well, I can tell you this for sure. After Katrina, certainly there's an element of people who felt like it was almost the storm was sort of a divine purge, you know. That's terrible to say, but there's certainly a group of people who felt that way. When the city was in as bad a shape as it was, as when I lived there, and the crime in those projects is pretty horrifying. But I'm not defending that position at all. Let's just say that the tensions after the storm, it became very obvious that the black community realized they were under siege, this idea that they would ever be able to come back and recreate the community as it had been.
Greg Iles, you have about 7 or 8 major characters, and they all interact. How planned are these books?
Different books for me are different. I'm a very instinctive writer. I'll go a long time without writing a word, and I sort of let the Jungian thing happen, you know, where the characters are working things out, and then I compare it to like a pregnant woman's water breaking, like, boom, the thing, I know it's time to sit down in the chair, and I start working 18 hours at a time. If you take these books, for example, I've always known the answer to the central knot about what happened between Tom and Viola. Did he kill her? If he did kill her, was it euthanasia or was he trying to keep her quiet? Is Lincoln Turner his? I've always known those things. Now, when you get out into the larger plot, how do you say I've been surprised? You're obviously surprising yourself if you're writing it. You know, I think we all, particularly writers, have sort of multiple personality disorder, and you can be surprised by certain things.
One major character dies. How surprising was that?
It was surprising. At one point, I was considering having the other character die, believe it or not. And that would have completely derailed
both of them.
Yeah, that's right. So you know, you get tempted. You know, I think we all need a guy standing behind us with a hammer when we get too tempted to try something almost for its own sake or to do the unexpected, you know?
In the last pages of Bone Tree, We don't have to give anything away here. Penn Cage confronts Forrest Knox. It's been the hero and the villain. And this has been pretty much, we knew where it was going from page one. What happens there? How planned was that?
You know, that was not planned. And it, and what makes Penn Cage kind of unique in this kind of fiction, and that's why I would say submit that Tobey Maguire is such a good guy to play him, is because Penn is more of an observer and a thinker than he is some kind of action character. And so, therefore, I think when he does, like there's a scene in Natchez Burning where he's one of the Knoxes, well, somebody who works for the Knoxes assaults him in the bathroom. And after being pretty considerably beat up, he does one brief savage thing. And it is so shocking to see a guy who's essentially nonviolent do something. And so I think when you're referring to that final scene, when you think about what he does in that, you know, I'll say this much. You know, I always saw the gun hanging on the holster on the hat rack. Let's not say too much. The thing with the hog and the rest of it, that was a surprise. But I love the way it worked out.
That brings up the question of that surprise itself, because I've talked to writers who say a character does something, and then at the same time, other writers will say, yeah, they're just pulling your leg.
You know, I've said that myself, because writers can sound so pretentious, when, especially when you hear it couched this way. You know, I'm going along, and it's a struggle, and I've got about 150 pages, but you sort of pass this magical point, and then the characters just rise up off the page and take over, and you just want to go, oh, God, give me a break. But that said, I'll go back to what I said about the Jungian thing. I really believe in that. You know, you've got your protagonists, your antagonists, and your shapeshifters, and they're sort of always in flux against each other. Certain potentialities exist. You, as the writer, sort of, what you're really there to do is determine how far each of those archetypes goes to fulfill what they are, and at what point do you stop them.
And when you're doing research, you also stumble on things that are serendipitous.
Absolutely you do. You hear things. I mean, I've been stunned before to hear things, and Stanley Nelson has told me things that stunned me. And I'll tell you what, for example, Frank Morris, the shoe repair man who was burned alive, who's the Albert Norris in the book, there's an extant photograph that a black Catholic minister sneaked a camera in. You know, it took Frank 3 days to die. And this courageous black Catholic minister, priest, sneaked a camera into his hospital room and took a picture of him while he was still alive in the bed. And you see a folded pair of hands of the African-American nurse tending him. And it is more horrifying than the picture of Emmett Till after his death, because Emmett Till was dead. Frank Morris is still alive, just prior to a coma. Things like that I didn't even explore in the book, because they're so, in a way, they're so sacred, and the cases are unresolved in a way.
Did you do much research on the Patriot Act to see how far Kaiser could go with?
I did enough to, yeah. you know, I'd always sort of the alarmist saying how terrible it was. I never really looked at it. And then when I finally did, I was shocked myself, particularly these national security letters, which are being largely abused right now by the DEA and people like that to do unauthorized searches. It's pretty shocking.
What do you think is the most serendipitous moment in either of these books? That moment where you get a piece of information, you've hit a dead end, and you finally go, there it is.
I don't know if I can even answer that. You know, I know what it is. In Natchez Burning, there's a photograph of Viola, the black and white nurses in Tom's clinic, and Tom in the picture, that Penn has been aware of since he was a child, and he has that nagging, almost Proustian feeling that we have, that there's information there he does not see. It ties into an experience he had when he was a child, and his father was supposed to pick him up late at night and never did, and left him out in the cold. And finally those two things come together, and they come together because of a smell. And he realizes that the night his father picked him up, the smell he remembered was the smell of Viola, the nurse. And it's a pretty stunning moment for him, and it leads him down another path.
Greg Iles, now you've killed off your main villain, and you have another book to go.
Yeah, he's got a brother. Snake is still alive.
So the third book turns into a cat and mouse game then.
No, the third book is actually the trial of Tom Cage. The third book is a murder trial that reveals finally everything about that was hidden in the first book. So as you said, the first book is more literary, historical, even though it's a thriller. The second book is more, as you've seen, almost a combat or lines are drawn, people betray each other. The third book returns to the first, like all classic, you know, literature, and we get the final unraveling of the knots.
How far into it are you?
There's an extant draft right now. I'll tell you what's different. I shouldn't say this, but I will. Because Natchez Burning was taken so seriously and got such reviews, you know, The Bone Tree was always more of a thriller. I went back and rewrote The Bone Tree to lift it more to the level of Natchez Burning. But the third book has always been better than the first. It's the best of the lot. But because of that, and because this book, just this series has probably doubled my readership and brought more attention. So given all that, if people are going to essentially read 2,200 pages by me, when they get to the end, I want to know they close that cover and say, by God, that was worth it, you know?
Do you think that moment when you said, screw the publisher, screw all that, something changed in you significantly then as a writer?
Yes. Those of us who are best-selling writers generally, we're making concessions to genre all along the way. You never have enough time. I've published many thrillers that were essentially second drafts, first and a half drafts, you know. Now, the guys like Thomas Harris are rare, who takes 7 years to produce a book. So you're always making a compromise. I still didn't have what I would call enough time to do these books justice, but I didn't pull a single punch. That's the difference. I just said, let the chips fall where they may. If I get sued or cussed or somebody tries to kill me, that's the way it goes.
One final question. Let's assume that Toby's in it, and this thing has actually happened, the trilogy becoming the Amazon series, correct?
You know, it's Hollywood. There's always a way out if they want to get out, but you know, this is happening, and we're shooting in Mississippi. It's going to happen.
How involved are you in the...
Well, I'm exec producing with Toby and with David Hudgens, and I just came from L.A. about 3 days ago. I met with Toby for 3 hours and with David, and they can always exclude the writer if they want to, but both guys have been very generous about asking my input, and it's just, so far, you know, it's been an honor and a pleasure. John Grisham advised me long ago how to deal with Hollywood. He said, Greg, you drive to the California border, you very tightly hand your book over with your left hand, you snatch the check with your right, you drive back to Mississippi, and you never think about it again. Now, John's had a lot of movies made, and I worry that he's right, but I'm gonna take my chance.
Well, Dennis Lehane had a slightly different view. He said he doesn't hand the book over until he knows that the other person at the other end has enough power to give him what he wants. So he hands the book to Scorsese or DiCaprio. He doesn't hand it to just anybody.
I got you. That's a good way to look at it.
That's how he does it. Are you going to write scripts?
Not for this. They asked me if I wanted to. I said no. You know, I think I've lived with this so long that I'm ready to go on to other things, and I don't want to be the guy that tries to take 2,200 pages and distill it down to something that's short.
And your next book after that, I would assume, is going to be not that next Penn Cage book.
You're right.
But something completely different.
You have no idea how different. That's right. Now, my publisher just shivered when I said that.
Well, think about poor George R. R. Martin still stuck in Westeros.
Oh, I can't even get my mind around that. And yet I'm as guilty as the fans because you think, okay, I don't want these screenwriters to just start writing what they want. I want what George wants, you know?
You've been listening to an interview with Greg Iles, whose novel is titled The Bone Tree. The earlier novel in the series is Natchez Burning, and there are 15 now novels in all, I believe.
Yeah, and I you know, just heard yesterday, thank goodness, The Bone Tree debuted at number 4 on the New York Times, and I only mention that because there are only a couple times a year where we as writers can sort of calm down and take a breath and feel like, well, I'm safe for a little while. You know, and so I'm in one of those modes today, slightly calm, you know.
I'm Richard Walensky on Book Waves.